I definitely think that a lot of people are in hospitality sort of thinking about wanting to have a life outside of work and not solely defining themselves by what they do for work, and wanting to have, like you say, other interests and other hobbies, and wanting to be able to sort of have a bit of control over their life rather than constantly waiting on a Sunday night for their roster to come out for the next week and then trying to plan their week at the last minute. And I think that's a great thing. I think everybody should be able to do that.
Dirty Linen is back after a couple of days break. A thank you to those very beautiful people who got in touch just to check that we were all okay over here. Honestly, I was just really busy working on a story about Joe Barrett, as it happens, one of the chefs we've actually been lucky enough to speak to on the podcast. And I have to say, I've just found it really hard to concentrate, and it took me longer to write the story than it normally would. I think my brain is a little bit foggy, and I don't think I'm the only one experiencing that. As we come to the end of another week, we find the whole Deep in the Weeds team in lockdown. So we're spread across Melbourne, where I am, Canberra, where Huck is, who does the Deep in the Weeds, my brother podcast, and Sydney, where producer Rob Locke is. So yeah, interesting. We haven't all been in lockdown since more than a year ago. Very interesting times. But today we are heading to country New South Wales to somebody who is luckily, thankfully, and at least not for now, not in lockdown. Charles Woodward is the chef at Sisters Rock Restaurant at Borrowdale. Charles, thank you so much for having a chat with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So you're near Orange, which was recently in lockdown, and it feels like there's another big swathe of country New South Wales, which, as we love to say, plunges into lockdown every day at the moment. What are things like around the Orange area at the moment?
Very quiet, I think, is the best way to describe it. We are suddenly realizing how reliant we were on people coming out from Sydney to sort of keep the town vibrant and going, I guess. It's for us especially, we rely heavily on that sort of tourism trade. So, yeah, even though we're not locked down, it almost feels like we still are. We're closing for extra services and trying to keep people busy around the estate rather than doing their sort of normal working week, I guess.
So what was it like when Orange was officially in lockdown? I mean, was it much different to the way it is now?
Yeah, I mean, we closed completely, obviously, with the guidelines. So we were sort of stuck at home. I live just outside Orange anyway, so I just kind of did my shopping and then was sat at home and took a bit of time to sort of sort my garden out, took some time to play with my kids and walk the dog. So it was quite relaxing, but I think any more than a week and it would have been maddening, I think, is the way I'd describe it. I can't sort of imagine what it's like for people in Sydney that are still locked down for that amount of time. It seems really quite crazy.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to your speculative descriptions around, yeah, it's really hard yards for people who are locked down for a long period, that is for sure, and especially in the hospitality industry where even if people are doing takeaway, it's just definitely not at the same pace for most people as they would be used to working. And it's, I think the uncertainty is something that a lot of people are grappling with and, yeah, finding particularly challenging. Charles, tell us a bit about Sisters Rock and Borrowdale. Just like set the scene for us a little bit.
So we're on the side of Mount Canobolas, which is a sort of ancient, now thankfully extinct volcano. So we're about halfway up. We're just over 1,000 meters. We predominantly are a small country restaurant and vineyard. We grow Gewürztraminer, Riesling, Chardonnay, Pinot, and a small amount of Pinot Meunier as grapes that we get made in the region. I'm pretty much exclusively available through either our cellar door or the restaurant. So we're easterly facing, so we get a really nice sort of gentle sunshine in the morning as you come through, and then in the afternoons it cools down pretty quickly. But it's today is a sort of beautiful, cloudless winter day, which is what I love out here is the weather, even though it's quite cold, not sort of there's no beach. It's just this beautiful rolling countryside. And we're on kangaroos down next to the restaurant, kookaburras, sheep, the whole sort of proper countryside living, I guess, is the best way to describe it up here. It's beautiful. We have persimmons, cherries, over 100 different types of heritage variety apples, 20 different varieties of plums. So there's a lot going on the estate. At any sort of given time of the year, there's always something growing and that you're able to sort of access very easily for the kitchen. It's pretty exciting to be out here, and having seen it go through for a whole year and watch the seasons change, it's really remarkable to see that. Whereas Sydney kind of gets a little bit warmer and then gets slightly not as warm. Melbourne is obviously changeable every day as to how the weather's going to be. But here it's quite reliable, and it's nice to see the sort of changing seasons coming through. It's an amazing place to sort of live and work, I think.
That's great. It sounds very idyllic, speaking from locked down Melbourne. So you've obviously worked, you know, in Victoria and in Sydney as well as country New South Wales. Just give us a bit of a go through your CV for us, Charles. Tell us where you've worked.
So I spent about 7 years working in London. Started out a restaurant called Launceston Place in London, and worked there for 2 years, and that was really my grounding. Then went to a few other places in London, came over, did the first part of my working holiday visa at the Lake House in Daylesford, then moved to Melbourne, worked on Lygon Street at the Roving Marrow, and then from there came up to the northern beaches of Sydney, worked at Cottage Point for 2 years, and then sort of looked to move on to do other things and bounced around a few really good restaurants in Sydney, but just couldn't sort of settle back into city life after being out in a Cottage Point is pretty much the furthest point away from the CBD while still being in what is considered metro Sydney, I guess. So after that, I kind of got the bug for the country New South Wales, I guess. So as soon as an opportunity came up to move out to Orange, as soon as I came out and saw Borrowdale, I was kind of hooked and I'm really keen to do it. So since last July, I've been out here and not looked back, really.
Is it the connection to produce that you love so much?
I think that's definitely part of it. I think it's for being a chef, it's the change of pace from sort of waiting around and doing those sort of hardcore hospitality hours that you have to do, especially sort of in the big cities like London and Sydney, where people go out and they expect to be able to eat and get a table at 9:30 and take their time and have a degustation menu and not be rushed to coming out to sort of country New South Wales and being where it's a bit more relaxed and people are more open to almost a dialogue between sort of the restaurant and the customer, where if you speak to them and sort of say like, oh, we're only open for lunch that day, they're far more accommodating. Most people are on some sort of break or holiday while they're here. So that's definitely been a big part of it. And also obviously the produce being that much closer to it. We have our own beef that we produce here. We have an abattoir out at Canaldra that does our beef and prepares that for us. We bring it back to the restaurant. We have a smokehouse on site. Just the space to be able to sort of experiment with things and be able to, with a bit less pressure, I think is a massive plus for moving out of one of the cities once you get to that point in your career where you've sort of done that, gained the knowledge, and then I find it much easier to put that into practice out here.
It's interesting. You know, a lot of people have gone through this pandemic period and they've realized how hard they've been working and that they just haven't stopped. And, you know, chefs or other people working in hospo have been able to spend more time with their kids perhaps, or doing, you know, fulfilling other interests, whether it's some sort of hobby or fitness or whatever it is. And I think a lot of people are, you know, going back into restaurant life as it reopens and wondering if they can sustain a bit more balance. You obviously, you know, made a move that you felt would give you a bit more, I guess, balance and perspective. I mean, do you reckon that it would be possible even in the cities to work in hospitality, but not work yourself into the ground?
I think it is possible. I think it's much more difficult. And I think it's, I still have friends who work there in Sydney and in Melbourne, and you speak to them and they're sort of like, oh, I wish I could get the hours that you've got, or but they don't want to live outside of Sydney. They don't want to give up the things that Sydney has to offer, sort of a nightlife and going out to bars is probably a big loss that you have moving out here. I mean, it's the Woolies closes at 9 o'clock. So if you miss that, then it's pretty much a ghost town after that. And I guess there's a balance between the two of where you're at in life, I think, as well, as to whether it's the right move for you. But I definitely think that a lot of people are in hospitality sort of thinking about wanting to have a life outside of work and not solely defining themselves by what they do for work and wanting to have, like you say, other interests and other hobbies and wanting to be able to sort of have a bit of control over their life rather than constantly waiting on a Sunday night for their roster to come out for the next week and then trying to plan their week at the last minute. And I think that's a great thing. I think everybody should be able to do that. And it's something that has to happen, I think, to get more people into the industry and to be keen to do it, because there is, as everyone knows, a huge shortage of not just chefs and back of house, but good front of house people who are not burnt out and are still keen to learn and sort of move on to different things and be more rounded individuals, I think. And that's only good for the industry if we can get that going.
How do you think this whole sort of supply chain can be improved so that it works better for everyone?
I think that is a really great point about things like Sundays. A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that, like, you have things like penalty rates and these businesses have to pay. And we're not talking about the bigger, larger sort of groups and stuff, but singular restaurants that are really struggling to make it in Sydney as standalone places that are maybe family owned or whatever, they're having to pay staff extra on a Sunday. And I think it needs to be sort of more widely known that the sort of costs involved in running a restaurant, people will say, well, you know, I can get a steak for $5 from Aldi. Why are you charging me $50 for a main course? Like, that seems, and when you put it into the basics like that, yeah, it is a markup, but there's all the other things that go into doing that. And it's, I think people, there's responsibility on both sides that if you have to offer value for money. And I don't think that necessarily comes from what you're putting on the plate. It comes from the warmth that you sort of give people as they arrive and throughout the meal and make it worth their while coming out to you. And people also have to realize that the costs involved in sort of running a restaurant are huge, and the toll it takes on people to keep that going it is massive. And I think it has to be a bit more understanding from both sides, I guess. And the way that we find staff and train staff has to improve But at the same time, some of that cost is going to be passed on to diners. And I think people are willing to pay for quality over quantity in a lot of instances. And I think that's what we kind of need to move towards for sure.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the more that people, I think the fact that dining out has become so ubiquitous it means that people don't see it anymore as a special occasion. Therefore, they don't see it as something that they need to pay special occasion prices for. And yeah. As much as we all love going out for a quick bite, it perhaps does devalue all the different elements that need to go into creating that experience for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can remember when I was a kid going out to a restaurant with my parents was like such a big deal. And it would happen like it always was a special occasion. There was never sort of a Wednesday night where we were just going out for something to eat. And I grew up in the UK as in a pretty middle-class family but it was always somebody's birthday or a special event when we were going out to eat, and it would be quite an occasion. So yeah, and now I'm guilty of it myself. I mean, we'll go out and eat like once or twice a week sometimes, whether it's just sort of grabbing breakfast or going out for dinner. And now sort of with lockdown, a lot of places have sort of upped their takeaway sort of offering, which makes it even more enticing. And that's, there's a place in Orange, Mr. Lim's, that does amazing sort of Korean food as takeaway. And it's pretty difficult to sort of turn that down on your way home when you know that you're just in time to sort of grab some of that and head home with it. But it does need to become, I think, more of an occasion thing and something that people are, it's not the norm, but at the same time, there's such a huge number of restaurants opening everywhere. I'm not really sure how you sustain the model of wanting to do that and all these restaurants opening and trying to staff all these restaurants in Sydney and in regional New South Wales. I know there's a lot of places looking to open here because there's been such an influx of sort of people from Sydney realizing that Orange is just a really easy 3.5 hour car drive away, or a short airplane trip even. I'm not sure how you balance that between all these new openings and lots of things that people want to do, and not being able to get staff from overseas is a huge one. And a huge sort of well that we were drinking from in Sydney, especially like these backpackers and people doing 6 month working holiday visas that are now just not there. And I know that that's causing problems for a lot of people. And especially when Sydney comes out of lockdown, it definitely will again, for sure.
Yeah, well, you were one of those people, so you well know how, definitely, you know, I know at Lake House there was always a really nice flow of working holiday visas, and some of those went on to be sponsored, and it was, yeah, really essential to the running of so many businesses, and I think especially in the regions. But, yeah, it's so interesting all those things that you say, Charles, and you touched on so many topics. It's interesting that you say, you know, you're guilty of going out to eat for something quick because, of course, we love the cafes and we love Mr. Lim and we want all those places to be there, but it's exactly as you say, it's how do we balance the fact that people want to open those kinds of places and the fact that people want to eat at them with a sort of some kind of just the costs and work out for everybody, you know, for the people that are eating there and for the people that are working there and of course for the producers down the line. It's such a complicated ecosystem, and we love the complexity of it because it gives us all kinds of different restaurants and cuisines and price points. But yeah, it does feel like it all has to be, everything just has to be raised a little bit and valued a bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think valued is definitely the right term. Because it is hard, and I think it's good, especially like out here we have great producers who are it's so difficult to not sort of rely on going. I know some of them definitely send a lot of produce straight to the Sydney markets because they know what they're going to get. They know that it's going to be taken on by a wholesale company and they don't have to worry about sort of getting it to the logistics of bringing it out to somebody else and dropping it there. So I think there's so many sort of issues facing it I think there has to be a bit of sort of blue sky thinking behind how we do that. I know at Borrowdale we've looked at it and sort of said, well, we've got a lot of land here, so we're going to try and set up a small farm. Our herb garden is currently sort of being pulled out and replanted, looking towards the spring and the summer and getting all the soil turned over and seedlings going into sort of hot houses and stuff so that we can try and cut costs by growing our own. But that's obviously something that's very easy to do when you're on a large estate like we are here, and something that's great and I've always wanted to do, and every sort of chef is really keen to do it. But how do you do it when you're in Sydney and there's not that option, I guess. It's a difficult sort of call as to how you balance that that need for quality plus over the money that you spend on those products to get that to the people at the price point and the quality point that you want to deliver to, I guess.
And I guess also, you know, chefs are so used to working with consistency. You know, it's when people are under such pressure and menus, you know, don't necessarily change that much, then they want to be able to tick a box on a list of produce and get, you know, know exactly what they're getting. But I think, you know, perhaps that's not quite the right way to think about produce.
It's a huge thing. It's one of the things that absolutely amazed me was when we had apple season out here and trying to cook a tartatin, an apple tartatin from one day to the next with apples that were coming off the tree day by day. And we'd literally get one day where the apples were perfect and they'd set and that you'd turn out this amazing tartatin, and then others where maybe if the rain had come and they'd taken on a lot of water, it was crazy how the produce that wasn't coming out of like a box that was being brought to your back door, and you were kind of going through these apples and just it was almost like guesswork trying to get them to work. And I'd never dealt with produce like that before, and it was crazy, and it really sort of frustrated me at first, but then I realized that it is how it should be, almost, that everything shouldn't come in and look exactly the same, and all your bell peppers shouldn't be exactly the same, and your pears are not always going to be that perfect sort of conference pear shape, and so yeah, that's definitely a thing that we've had to adapt to, where we run out of something and we have to move on to something. So we've really started to try and make the most of the produce we have here by moving into sort of ferments and pickles, or like turning stuff into sorbets that can be kept and bases, and so that we have a product that we can rely on going forward and make the most out of it, because it is far more sort of volatile produce that you're getting when you're just picking them in. And I was really surprised, and I guess I'd never really thought about it until I got out here, when you just have things turn up at the back door of the kitchen every day and you go in and you know that like all the carrots are going to be the same size and they're going to cook in this amount of time, and it makes your cooking, I guess, simpler in a lot of ways, because you have to pay far more attention to what the produce that you have in your hands and how it's going to react to what you do with it, which is a huge eye-opener for me coming out here, especially where we have a lot of produce coming straight out.
But yeah, I mean, that is so interesting and really just feels Yeah, like that tart to tan. It's like that could be a turning point in your whole life where you start to relate to produce in that different way. That's really, really, it's really amazing. And I suppose it sort of relates to all the things we've already been talking about. I sort of feel like you were a bit frustrated, but then you kind of dealt with it. Like in a kitchen where you've got 150 booked and you just need to get stuff done, and perhaps it's not, you know, the head chef as you are dealing with it, but it's someone, you know, a bit down the line who's freaking out because they just, you know, they've got all these jobs they need to get done. I think I think you need the time to attend to those kinds of things, don't you? That you need the time to relate to produce when you're thinking about it as this living ingredient, not just, you know, something that's on a list or, you know, an item in a recipe. And then it also relates to this whole idea of communication and conversation with the diner, that the diner has to be more understanding that, you know, the menu changes because the produce changes. We've sort of got to break out of some of these strictures that we've put ourselves in.
Yeah, I've been that guy in a sort of one or two Michelin star kitchen where something just doesn't react for whatever reason because your supply has changed and it's moved to something that's imported rather than a sort of local product, and it does something that you're completely not expecting, and you're literally working down to sort of looking at the clock and going, okay, I know that I'm on time now, and then it just throws your whole morning out, and you're looking around and you're trying to sort of work out how you can save your day and not have somebody turn around and sort of scream at you and go. So yeah, it's definitely that a different way of thinking from that. And as you move up and become sort of a head chef or move into a position where you're making those decisions, I think it's really important as well, going on that point, to sort of remember where you came from and how it was sort of being that guy who's trying to work a section. And for sure, I've had to sort of stop and think about that myself, especially with those sort of issues now that we face here, and go, you just have to sort of make a change and sort of stand there, and you do have to communicate to diners and make sure that you have a great working relationship with your front of house team so that you can go to them and explain to them, and they can then put that to a diner and say, this has changed, we're going to do this now. It's one of the reasons that we have a menu that we print every day rather than sort of saving copies and sending it off to a printing company, so that we can print it and make sure that anything that we need to move on from one day to the next is completely possible.
Because, I mean, really, as a diner, I feel like that's why I would go to a restaurant. It's because I want to know, you know, what is the expression of this place at this time? There's that way of approaching dining. I guess there's so many other ways that we've built up in our dining culture, you know, like going somewhere for some kind of famous dish where they always have to have the snapper or whatever it is. And sometimes a year, maybe that snapper comes from further and further away. But they always need to have it on the menu. I mean, so we get ourselves into trouble with some of these things, don't we?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's like one of the reasons that a lot of places are sort of dropping the a la carte and moving on to these degustation menus is so that you've got a bit more flexibility there, because everybody's getting the same thing and you don't have to be able to, people are expecting it to change a bit more often, and probably people aren't going to those restaurants like every month and wanting the same thing. They're going there and they are more of those special occasion restaurants where people are going every few months and seeing things change, and there's not the pressure on you to sort of have five different mains that you're constantly going through and have these ebbs and flows of where it can depend on the weather or who's coming in as to whether you're going to sell like 20 cod for a 50 cover lunch service or 5 cod for a 50 cover lunch service. So having that degustation menu, and I think it's a huge part of why they're becoming more and more popular for restaurants to run is that lack of wastage and making the ease of sort of ordering and keeping on top of your what you're holding in the fridges and in your walk-ins, I guess, which is, I guess it's got pluses and minuses for everybody. We've narrowed our menu down to a four-course a la carte where there's a set first course and three entrees, three mains and three desserts, just because it's not viable now to have these huge menus with sides and like five or six mains on. You just can't hold that sort of produce and hope that you just get through it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think the fact, you know, having your own cattle and working with the abattoir, that must make a big difference to the way that you think about beef?
Yeah, it's huge. The way that where you try and hit on ways of using your sort of secondary and tertiary cuts and how can you make them as appealing as possible over sort of everybody wanting to go get a sirloin or a piece of fillet. I'm making the most of those other pieces, like making sure that you're making stocks from bones and things like that. And we get whole pigs now. We make sure that everything gets used out of those, whether it's we've started to make our own salami that in our new sort of wine bar, we'll be able to serve our own like house-made charcuterie. We have a smokehouse on site. So from that point, it's really useful for us to have all those things on hand already and be able to do that. But you do have to, it takes a lot more thought and a bit more planning. And there will be the times when you sort of sit down at the beginning of the week and go, what am I hoping to do? How am I going to make this work? And how can I get the best out of every cut that comes through the door and sort of treat it as the tertiary and secondary cuts in a way that makes them as valuable as your primary cuts of sort of steak beef, I guess.
I mean, I suppose in a way, the value in those cuts is that you do have to put that thought and perhaps, you know, a few extra steps into making them really delicious.
Yeah. And again, I think that's a big part of being able to work with your front of house team and sort of take the time to educate them about why it's so great that you've got this chuck steak that you've maybe like brined and barbecued, or we use pork neck as a really good example of that, where it's marinated in a koji that's made locally to help break it down. And that sort of, you then want to pass that on to your diners, because the people are coming here to sort of have something different and wanting to see something that they maybe haven't seen before or definitely wouldn't sort of eat at home. So it's really important that you can convey that message and why it's, I definitely feel more so now than I did sort of 5 years ago that it's really important to have a really good working relationship with whoever's working front of house with you, and because they're the sort of middleman who's conveying that what you're trying to do and what your ethos is onto the people who are coming in and sitting in the restaurant and eating the food and ultimately paying the money for it.
Yeah, it's definitely so important, especially when there is such a story behind what you're serving. You really want to get that across. So how are you finding it for staff over there at Borrowdell?
it's a challenge. I'm really lucky that I've got a really solid kitchen team. Marcello, I worked with him briefly while I was at Pillow at Freshwater, and he'd been there for a while, and he was looking for a change. So when I moved, he came with me. And I'm very grateful that the way that Giovanni was so gracious in letting him move with me and didn't hold that grudge against me for it. So, and then I have a great apprentice and another guy who was already here when I started, and they've stayed with me. And I think it's really important that you can keep people like that together. And then front of house, we really struggle for front of house staff at the moment. We have some great people, but there's just not enough of them around. And again, it's maybe taking people who don't have that hospitality background and trying to work with them and upskill them, I guess, is sort of one way. And you've got to put the work into people. You're not going to have people turn up who are already superstars, or very rarely, out here, especially when we're that little bit out of town. It, in a small town, makes it even harder, I guess, than some of the restaurants that are in town. But yeah, you definitely have to put the work, or not the work into people, but I guess put the effort into offering them training and making it, make them want to stay and want to work and want to buy into what you're trying to do and get them on board as well. We try and teach them, get them in to eat in the restaurant with their partners or their family, and make sure they sort of understand what it's like to be a diner in a restaurant like ours. And then we try and do some work around the estate with our sort of staff and do some outings where we go and see some of the producers that we do use and are around. Like Pioneer Brewery, we're going to go out there and sort of get to know those guys, take the front of house and the kitchen team out there and sort of have a day out of work where you have that sort of bond and everybody becomes a bit more familiar with each other and becomes, I hate the thing of calling the people you work with a family, because it's such a cliche, but you just become, I guess, even friends that you want to sort of help each other, and you can come together as towards a common goal of sort of improving the whole offering and making it somewhere that people want to come to work, and it's not a sort of chore. Because I know I've definitely worked in places where I'd wake up in the morning and sort of dread having to go to work. And that's the last thing I want for anybody that sort of that works here, for sure.
Yeah, well, that all sounds really nice. It sounds like a good place to work. Charles, Sydney's really in the thick of it. And you mentioned that it's that's a large part of your trade. I mean, how do you see the next few months rolling along?
It's really... It's worrying, to be honest. We were already planning before all this happened to sort of go to Lunches Only and open for an extra day. We were normally doing Thursday to Sunday lunch and dinner, and we were going to cut our dinner services and open on Mondays, thinking that there was a market where people who came here from Sydney might have taken that Monday off and were looking for somewhere to have lunch before they leave. And now that's sort of thrown a massive spanner in the works. We do a lot of functions. We're a really popular wedding venue, and obviously people are just postponing them and postponing them and not knowing when they're going to be able to do them. I heard today that there's talk of the lockdown not lifting till December. So it's really uncertain times, and we've got a lot of projects and a lot of things we want to get done that maybe would have waited till next year that we're kind of pushing through now, I guess. But there's only so long you can keep that going without the money coming into the restaurant. So yeah, it's worrying, and I do wonder how, whether we can carry on like this and we can keep just locking down and saying, well, don't do anything, while nothing seems to really change in terms of numbers and what's happening with it, and the sort of poor flow of information about vaccines and who's eligible, how you can get them and where they are. I think there needs to be a much clearer message around that, for sure would help us.
What's the vaccine's situation in Orange? Is it easy to go get jabbed?
I've been told that I would have to wait twice now. So I've got to say, no, I know there are some people that have been, the more vulnerable groups have sort of, they're getting through them. But it's certainly not a system that I think has been rolled out well at all. There's not off the top of my head, I wouldn't have known where to go to get a vaccine or how to access one. And I think there definitely needs to be a better rollout across the whole of New South Wales. And the way that the message is sort of put to people needs to be much clearer, so that there isn't this panic and this wondering about if it's safe or not. It's certainly something that needs to be done, but the way it has been done, I think, is terrible, to be honest.
Yeah, well, you're certainly not the only person in regional New South Wales that I've heard that from. So I hope that they do sort it out and make the access and the messaging really clear, because it's so important that everybody who can get vaccinated does get vaccinated. Charles, if I was lucky enough to come and eat with you in the next little while, what's something that you would feed me?
I think at the moment we've got a great little vegetarian dish on as an entree that I'm really keen to sort of make sure that our vegetarian dishes are something that's really stand out. We use a goat's curd from Yanai Dairy in Lithgow, with a confit egg yolk from an egg producer called Carabine Pasture, which are hands down the best eggs I've ever tasted. So we confit those in a local olive oil, and that goes with roasted Jerusalem artichokes, and then a green juice, which is sort of the trim from a lot of the herbs that we use in other dishes, and nettles and sort of greenery we can pull from around the estate, and then sort of seasoned with cider apples that are juiced for their sweetness to balance sort of the bitter, spicy flavors of the greens. And then a crumb made from a house smoked guanciale from pigs that are supplied by our accountant. So it's a real sort of local dish with lots of different parts for us to do that really shines out. So I think that's a great dish.
Love the sound of it. It just totally sounds like the region on a plate. Although I would just ask you not to put the guanciale on if someone is actually vegetarian.
We do a rye crumb that's for the vegetarian, and it's just moved over. So our rye crumb that we make in-house is turned round for the vegetarians, absolutely.
It just sounds so good. I mean, everything that you're saying is just, you know, obviously there's such reverence for the local producers, and then there's the stuff that you're doing on the property as well. It just sounds so good. So even more motivation for us to get out of lockdown. I reckon it's going to be a while before I'm allowed to come to New South Wales, Charles, but it's been so great to chat to you today. Thank you so much for your insights and perspective on the industry. It's been really fantastic to have a chat.
Awesome. That's great. Thanks a lot, Danny.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you.